Good morning. Before we begin our discussion on the merits, we have a little administrative matter to address.
I'd like to put on the record, Bruce Nakamura was not, I guess he was not on the papers before the oral argument, so we weren't aware, I wasn't aware that he was going to participate in the case. But we're not related, but I do know Mr. Nakamura in two respects. One, we were basketball competitors in the Lawyers League, so I know him from that relationship. But also, his family is neighbors with my wife's family. I guess it's a cul-de-sac. They're sort of across the way in the cul-de-sac. Although, as you can see, he's much younger than I am. So, and my wife's my age. So they grew up together, and I think his parents and my in-laws still live next door to each other. So we do visit, we see each other in the context of visiting my in-laws and his family. In my view, it doesn't create a situation where I feel that I can still be fair and impartial in the case. And so I don't believe it provides grounds for disqualification or recusal. But I wanted to disclose that on the record and perhaps give you a chance to think about it and figure out how we should proceed from this point.
Would you like us to take a short recess while you decide? I know your client's not here, so. Okay, so we'll take a short recess and we'll ask the bailiff to call us when you're ready to decide. Thank you. Mr. Thomason? Okay, thank you. You may proceed.
Maybe we should ask Mr. Nakamura also, is there any problem in your behalf in terms of my staying it on the case?
Thank you.
Your Honor, we stand by our written submissions already placed before the court. We ask that the court indulge us in addressing two points that we feel should be emphasized for the court's consideration. Our client, Communication Specific or Compact, as referred to in the briefs, sought in this action two remedies, a declaratory judgment finding that the city's act of inserting a favored contractor was wrongful because it awarded Compact's expected work to an entity that did not participate in any competition and had not been reviewed by the selection committee. Compact also sought damages for the economic injury it suffered as a result of the city's actions. The lower court's ruling was based on a 12B6 and 12B1 motion, and it found that Compact's action had to be dismissed because the procurement code provided an exclusive remedy for any objections arising from a procurement process. We contend that the lower court was in error and in this ruling because Communication Specific's injuries are individual and separate from the procurement parties, and that these injuries are not addressable under the procurement code's protest procedures. As the city has objected to Communication Specific's arguments for a couple of reasons, and we ask that the court reject, or they ask the court reject this type of action complaining of errors in the procurement code because, according to the city, it would disrupt the procurement process. We submit that the city's concerns are unfounded, and actually they're in opposite of the realities of the procurement code and the action that Communication Specific asserted here. The unique characteristics of a protest remedy is the automatic stay. In the federal system, in our Hawaii procurement code system, all of the state and all of the states that follow the model procurement code, a stay is imposed on any procurement action the moment a timely protest is filed. There's no obligation on the part of the protester to prove the merits of their arguments to obtain the stay. It's simply the filing of the stay. The procurement code, in balancing the interests of the public and ensuring that his funds are spent responsibly and correctly, is weighed against the need of the government to proceed efficiently in the awarding of contracts and the pursuit of the contract work. Because of this automatic stay provision, there is a natural tendency on the part of the government agencies to be reluctant to allow a broad class of persons to be able to protest. And that's why in our protest system, only prospective and actual bidders, offerors, and contractors have a right to protest. That means that that broad class of subcontractors may not protest. There's no dispute about that. The briefs submitted by the city, went into great detail asserting that Compaq does not have a right to protest. We agree. That's not a point and issue. The real question is whether this judicial action, as the city claims, would in fact disrupt procurement activities, and we submit that it would not.
So let me see if I understand the issue. So you're not disputing, or are you, the legislature's power to create a statutory scheme in which a subcontractor in your position would be barred from raising any claim? In other words, does the legislature have the power to do that? My understanding is that you're not arguing that the statutory scheme itself is unconstitutional. The focus is on how do we interpret this exclusive remedies provision and as a matter of statutory interpretation, whether that bars the claim that you're making in this lawsuit.
That's correct. The legislature has a right to formulate a scheme of remedies under such programs as the procurement code. The argument we're presenting is by creating an exclusive remedy for the direct participants in that scheme, the legislature did not create, eliminate, or change in any way the independent rights of other persons who may have suffered an injury as a result of the government's actions in the process.
The question is, could it? I mean, does the legislature have the power to have said, okay, this is exclusive remedy, we're going to knock out the subcontractor's common law remedy and not give them any remedy under the statute? I understand you're saying that they didn't do that, but my question is, could they have done that?
I believe they could have, not having the advantage of in-depth research. Obviously, there are property interests that are held by the citizens that may not be trampled by the government. But as long as the government provides a remedy of some kind, the courts may disagree about the adequacy of the remedy. I believe as long as the government provides a remedy of some kind, the legislature can draw a line where one party may only use the exclusive procedures. And what we're saying is in this context, that doesn't mean those parties who were not included in the class cannot pursue the existing remedies that there's no indication in the code were excluded or removed.
Well, even before the procurement code was adopted, at common law, you had to have privity in order to sue the government to challenge a bid.
That's correct. And the one caveat that I would add for that, Your Honor, is that in the process of awarding a contract, there's a duty of fair consideration on the part of the government toward all the competitors. Privity would be only created at the time the contractor is selected and the contract is awarded. So in common law, a competitor who felt that they had not received fair consideration from the government could apply, at least in the federal government, for a remedy for failure to receive fair consideration of their proposal. With the passage of the Competition and Contracting Act, that was changed, and so now the federal government has an exclusive protest procedure that's very similar to what we have in our model procurement code.
You mentioned that Compaq had a expectation, I guess, of a business opportunity, I guess, with Parsons. Where is that in the record? Was that part of the submission by Parsons to the city?
In our complaint, we included a number of exhibits. Those exhibits, in part, included Parsons' proposal to the city, because the city's solicitation required all competitors to identify the prime key personnel and all subcontractor personnel. So necessarily, Parsons nominated Communications Pacific as its subcontractor for the public affairs outreach. That evaluation, or the evaluation by the city, actually looked at Parsons' inclusion of Communications Pacific as an active subcontractor performing the work that was being solicited. The expectation that Communications Pacific received as it joined the Parsons team, assisted the Parsons team in preparing the proposal and actually formulating a total cost for the contract, Communications Pacific received a reasonable expectation that if Parsons won, Communications Pacific would continue as a member of that team.
Well, how do we draw the line, though? Under your analysis, would that mean that any time a contractor or a subconsultant identified in the proposal was changed before the contract was finalized, that either they would have to start all over again, or that that contractor who was changed would have a potential claim for interference with economic advantage? I mean, how do we distinguish your case and not make it apply in all situations?
I think you should and can distinguish in these cases where there is a solicitation and nominated subcontractors, that a subcontractor can be removed only if the government has cause. We have within our system a responsibility determination that can lead to suspension and debarment from participating in state contracts. In this case, if Communications Pacific was not responsible in some way, or was had suffered some ethical error in the past that gave the city concern that it was not an appropriate contractor to serve on a city contract, Communications Pacific would have a due process right to defend that action under our suspension and debarment procedures. This exclusive remedy really covers three areas. One is the award. Solicitation award of contracts. The second portion of our procurement system allows the city and the state, each of the chief procurement officers, to debar contractors that lack the ethical standards or financial resources, or for some reason are not a qualified contractor.
But shouldn't the city be able to negotiate short of establishing that one of the subcontractors or subconsultants were debarred? In other words, isn't part of the negotiation process with the contractor, the city have some leeway to object or recommend different subcontractors? And if we're saying that if they do that, and then but short of the person being debarred, they're subject to this lawsuit, I mean, doesn't that create the problems that this exclusive remedy provision was designed to avoid?
No, Your Honor. I believe the correct interpretation of this negotiations process is that the government official continues to have a clear obligation to the public that all contract work will be awarded through competitive processes. So if a contractor nominates a subcontractor that is not an appropriate subcontractor for one reason or other, the evaluation can evaluate them low. There are rights to engage in discussions between prime contractors and subcontractors in both the professional services awards and sealed proposal award systems. In that process, the government can inform a prime contractor that they have a flawed proposal, that they have a weak contractor, they will be scored low, and they need to address that themselves. The government always defines what the work is, and the government also defines what the standards of performance will be. But the government does not pick, without competition, who does the work. The distinction I think the court should apply and insist that city and state officials apply is that in these negotiations, the government may say, we believe that this work requires qualified persons to do this type of work. But the government cannot say, we have a contractor, or we know a contractor, or we recommend a contractor, because then they're nominating outside the competitive procurement process a favored contractor. The protections of the procurement code are that it's the contractor that goes out, identifies an appropriate subcontractor, nominates that subcontractor, has that subcontractor evaluated based upon their qualifications, skills, and other published evaluation criteria. And then the government only rejects when that subcontractor, for one reason or other, is not responsible.
So you're saying that if that was the situation, in other words, if the city just said, hey, you got a subcontractor in there, we don't like that subcontractor, then you would not have a claim for interference with economic advantage. You would only have a claim if the city said, and we want you to put in a different subcontractor. In other words, if the city stopped that, we're uncomfortable with this subcontractor, we recommend or we ask that you find some other qualified person, you wouldn't have a claim for interference.
I believe you would not, because the government is fulfilling its obligation to award the public's work in a competitive process based upon the statement of work that's provided in the published solicitation. The danger that we are cautioning against, and we believe that the city's argument in this case invites the court to adopt, is a rule that says those subcontractors who are included in this evaluation process have no remedy anywhere, because the result is that process of the city saying, or the government at any level saying, this contractor is a good contractor, in effect nominating outside the competitive process a specific favored contractor, you're inviting corruption. We haven't alleged corruption here, we've alleged only an error. But the process, the invitation in this argument presented by the city is that this court will say that that process of suggesting a subcontractor by the state, by a government official, is okay, creates within the very fabric of all of our laws governing public conduct an immunity. Our procurement code says all work has to be awarded through competition unless a very narrow sole source procurement is performed and justified. We have ethics codes that require contractors or require government officials not to use their position to benefit any specific person. And we have campaign spending laws that are targeted at preventing patronage or pay-to-play, any mechanism by which a government official can influence the direction that government monies, taxpayer dollars, go as a reward for the support of a specific political
figure. But isn't there a safeguard built into the scheme, or a potential safeguard in the sense that the loser of this process could always protest? In other words, the loser in this case would have had standing to protest what you're claiming was an improper substitution of subcontractor. So I mean,
the loser could
maybe it doesn't work in every case, but is that something built into the scheme that would address your concerns about protecting the integrity of the system?
I would suggest that it absolutely would not. The interests of the losing contractor are not the same as the subcontractor of the winning contractor. We have, in the Carl case, a detailed discussion about reliance on other persons to vindicate the public interest in public contracts being awarded competitively and fairly. In the Carl case, the Supreme Court noted it's a crime, it's a misdemeanor to violate the procurement code. But relying on the prosecutor to vindicate the public's right is not sufficient. is not enough. I would submit it's not enough for the public's interest in a procurement code of assuring full, fair, and open competition to rely on the losing contractor to protest, especially when you consider we recently have had an amendment to our procurement code that requires the posting of a punitive bond with the hearings officers at DCCA in any application for administrative review of a denial of a protest. There are costs that accompany pursuing a protest, both monetary and goodwill with the government agency that has been that's being charged. The losing contractor has already suffered the expense of performing the proposal preparation. It hopefully will have opportunities in the future, and very seldom will a contractor, unless they truly feel wronged, pursue a protest before any government agency. For the courts to rely on that one reluctant loser to vindicate the public's rights is, I believe, inadequate. And I would encourage the court to look to the person who actually suffers the wrong to raise the issue and make sure that the public's interests in that losing and the subcontractor, the wrong subcontractor, actually raise for themselves the complaint they have, because reliance on the prosecutor or a reluctant losing prime contractor is inadequate to ensure that the public's interests are adequately protected.
What do we do about the fact that your client basically said, well, if you're going to play this way, I don't want to be part of this? I mean, does that take her... Does your client have standing anymore?
I believe she continues to have...
As a sub?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. My response to that would be, the issue here is whether our client has a remedy at all. I recognize that a prospective repudiation of the $25,000 contract might cause us to lose that amount of money that our client's president elected not to pursue. But on the other hand, I think we argue vigorously that in the context of this entire procurement scheme, the city's response to our client's informal questions and informal objections was absolute rejection. Our client also sought to forego judicial remedy by pursuing a declaratory ruling from the Procurement Policy Board, of which there is a statutory right and a constitutional right to petition for redress of grievances before the government. That was mailed back to us with the city's council's opinion as the basis for rejecting. I believe that on the merits of the limitations on damages, there may be an obligation for my client to forego the $25,000 reduction in total damages received. However, I would suggest that does not affect standing. At the time she made the repudiation, her company had already suffered the tort we complained of, and the requirement for the request for a declaratory judgment remains available to her without regard.
Is there any reference in the legislative history of the exclusive remedies provision that focuses on standing or the role of subcontractors as opposed to the actual bidder or contractor?
I'm not aware of any that would answer the court's questions in this case.
Apparently this was part of it. This is not unique to Hawaii, so there are other states that have similar types of procurement code provisions. Is there anything to the fact that Hawaii's apparently appears to be more restrictive than the other editions of this particular statute? Is that something we can read into indicating that the legislature really wanted to limit the litigation that would arise out of this process?
I would submit that, yes, Hawaii has adopted the more restrictive, like the federal government, restrictive reading that the protest class, the class of individuals who can pursue a protest, is limited only to prime contractors. That's the only reading that you can read into it. Any interpretation of the procurement code that says that violations of the procurement code cannot be raised independently by persons who have an independent tort, I believe is inappropriate. And we have cited to the Omori versus Ikai case as the logical analogy, that if there's an exclusive remedy, that exclusive remedy applies to the persons who have been identified as able to use it. But if there are others injured by the same conduct in a different way, where they have received or injury and they have a common law or another statutory remedy, they are still free to use that. They just cannot go through the procurement protest procedure, which gives that automatic stay without proof to stop the procurement in its tracks.
Under the federal system, though, there are certain exceptions when subcontractors can bring a protest to the government review board or contracting board, and one of them is when the government has participate in the selection of the subcontractor to such an extent that they basically controlled that process. And they seem to have rules on that, but
that's correct.
Does our board, our policy board, have rules?
There are a number of federal rules that allow for a protest when the contractor, where the subcontractor is actually selected by the government official. And the analysis is similar here. In effect, what the government official has done is, without issuing a solicitation, without identifying the work, without providing other contractors an opportunity to compete, made an individual selection as to a subcontractor. But I believe you'll find that there are later GAO decisions where protests are more constrained, and that type of action frequently can be complained to the federal government, to the inspector generals, who have independent authority to review procurement actions to prevent abuse of government funds and abuse of authority by procurement officers, for the same reasons that we have argued here that we should be able to go to the court. The federal government allows the inspector generals to independently receive those complaints and act on them.
But your argument would be much easier if the language of the exclusive remedies provision was the same as the language of the remedies provision, because the exclusive remedies provision, the way it's written, is written in a way that can be construed, at least, as being broader than the remedies provision.
I believe it cannot, and I would offer this to you for your consideration. The protest procedure of 701 addresses only those issues that relate to the solicitation award of a contract. The following section addresses to the remedies that are available for the state to debar and the contractors to defend in a debarment action. The third section of our remedies subchapter provides for contractor disputes, meaning contract controversies, where the contract's been awarded, the contractor has the contract, is proceeding with the work, and there's some disagreement on the interpretation of the contract, award of delay damages, or some equitable adjustment in price that the contractor and the government can't agree on. It allows the contractor a remedy. Then when you get to the end, the exclusive remedy provision, what it's really talking about is it's talking about all of those remedies being the exclusive remedies for that group. So instead of saying, as in the protest remedy, saying prospective and actual bidders, offerors, and contractors, it has to address all three of those remedies, and it says persons who are aggrieved by any action under the protest, or by any action in the award of a solicitation, award of a contract, or a debarment action, or a dispute or contract controversy, as our statute says.
You're saying we should read those provisions in paramaterium?
Yes, I do, and I believe this court has always, in applying questions of legislative interpretation, tried to interpret the statute as a whole and make it harmonious. I believe relying only on the language in the exclusive remedies clause to define for you who can be a protester is not a logical application of your obligation to read the statute as a whole. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
May it please the court. morning, Your Honors. It's an honor for me to be able to present our arguments this morning. And I think that I would like to start with Your Honor, Judge Nakamura's questions and concerns focusing on the language of the exclusive remedies provision. In fact, the exclusive remedies provision that was adopted by the legislature in 704 is broader than the ABA Model Act, or in fact, apparently, as the Supreme Court said, apparently any other procurement code that they've looked at. That quote is set forth in our answering brief, and it was taken from the Clapp decision, where the court looked at the fact that 701 creates the basis or creates your independent standing in order to file a protest if you are a actual prospective offeror, bidder, or contractor who's been aggrieved in connection with the solicitation or the awarding of a contract.
But in this case, Compaq isn't challenging the award of the contract. They're just challenging the government requirement that that Parsons substitute a consultant.
Well, we believe that the Compaq is fundamentally challenging the composite of the award, the makeup of the award, the manner in which the award was granted. You have to understand, this is not, at the time that the proposals came in, this wasn't a request for proposal, it was a request for qualifications. This is not governed under a competitive sealed bidding process. This is a procurement for professional services. At the time the notice goes out requesting these qualifications, the government hasn't figured out what the scope of work is going to be. It's a developing process. And so when the proposals are received and there's a determination of the qualified contractors, there's a listing of proposed team members that are on there. There were 21 proposed subconsultants that came in under Parsons' initial submittal. The makeup of the final contract, 7 of those proposed contractors were gone. 5 new contractors were added. It's because the city has to be given the flexibility during this process on a procurement for professional services to develop the scope of work. Specifically in section 304 subpart F, there's specific mention to the fact that the selection committee procurement officer, chief procurement officer, is entitled to conduct confidential negotiations with bidders to develop the scope of services, the type of services that are going to be provided. Thereafter,
what the normal practice of the city is, because when you look at the statute, every year the city is supposed to go out and do a RFQ, I guess, for professionals, and then you decide whether they're qualified, sure. And then as jobs come up, then you decide who of those qualified lists will do a particular job. This is a totally different type of procurement, right? Because it was specific to the rail corridor.
Well, yes, and we were asking for the city's RFP was for alternative analysis and draft EIS. And so you only had 2 massive proposals that came in, Parsons and EarthTech. Those were the 2 qualified bidders. The relevant code section that governs what the city is supposed to do in issuing this procurement deals with how you deal with the bidders, how you deal with the prime contractors. It doesn't get into the minutiae of how you deal or what the composite of the subcontracting team is going to be. It couldn't. It fundamentally could not happen at that point in time. The city has to be given...
The one question that gives me pause is the exclusive, it seems odd that an exclusive remedies provision would bar a claim without giving that party some claim under the statute. In other words, in the work comp context, or you give up your right to sue in tort, but you have a remedy, the statute which stops you from suing in tort gives you a remedy under the statute. Here, it appears that what the city's arguing is that in this case, for a subcontractor or a subconsultant, there's an exclusive remedies provision that bars them from raising any claims in connection with a contract award, But the statute that bars those common law claims doesn't give them any remedy. Does that seem like a disconnect in terms of the statutory scheme?
We don't think it's a disconnect. Now, keep in mind, 704 does not give a subcontractor independent standing to file a protest. But we would assert, as we set forth in our answering brief, the remedy is through Parsons. And in fact, the trial court, in her reasoning, specifically said, well, it is theoretically possible that Parsons could have lodged a complaint on behalf of Compaq, and that's absolutely true.
But does a sub have a right to compel the general or the bidder to file a protest?
Well, there's nothing in the procurement code that would have prevented Compaq in their dealings with Parsons before they were agreed to be a part of this team to negotiate an obligation or secure an obligation on the part of Parsons to make sure they maintain their ability to raise this protest. Remedies that are within the code, there is a provision. Remedies before the issuance of a contract, remedies after the issuance of the contract. Specific in those sections, 706 and 707, it says one of the remedies is if there has been a violation of the code, the procurement officer has the discretion to modify the contract. In 706, it says modify the contract to make it in compliance with the law. In 707, it says revise the contract accordingly. These are specific remedies that are available to the city, to the procurement officer, in order to address those types of defects. So we would assert it was completely within Compaq's control to secure their rights and go through Parsons. The fact that they either chose not to do that or was not able to secure that type of an obligation shouldn't fall on the city's hands. And it's, you know, from a broader perspective, I think it goes towards the policy, argument that we would like the court to follow the clear language of the statute. It's exactly the reason why the city doesn't want to become embroiled in contractor, subcontractor disputes, especially when they're trying to figure out the scope of the work in the first place.
But isn't the process that you're supposed to pre-qualify consultants and then so you've determined they're qualified, and then now you're going to say you're unqualified because your sub is not qualified anymore?
The requirements as to qualified qualifications of the consultants relate to the bidder of the project. So in this case, Parsons. It does not extend the language of the statute, and there's nothing in the legislative history in this code that says that requirement of qualification extends to every single possible subcontractor that could be part of this team. The RFP notice asked for proposed team members, which included subconsultants. And again, we said there were 21 that came in on the original, 5 new ones, 7 got left off the list.
Tell me about who. There's a letter in the record from Mr. Hamayasu or whoever, from the Department of Transportation, saying that you did not like the approach of Compaq in the public relations aspect, that you needed technical people. So what is it about this firm that the city required to be substituted that's different?
That's true, Your Honor. Thank you for bringing that up. That letter is part of the record. It was a letter from Tora Hamayasu to, I believe, Councilman Todd Apo, following a public hearing where the change in the scope of the work was raised and addressed during the course of that proceeding. But what the letter confirms is that the scope of the project, after Parsons was selected as the most qualified bidder and the city proceeded with permitted confidential negotiations as to the types of services that they're going to be providing, the scope of services. As the letter sets forth, there was a mutual understanding or agreement that the traditional PR format in terms of that was going to be a part of this process, public relations component, that Compaq was designing to offer was not going to really be adopted in this particular case. The concern that the city and Parsons jointly came up with was that they wanted to try and address the underserved and people and the constituency out there on the west side, and they thought a traditional PR model of a website, public hearings and just scheduling yet another public hearing for people that they're trying to reach that typically show up at would have to show up again would kind of defeat the purpose. So they decided, for the PR standpoint, getting the message out or getting the information out about this project to the public, it would be more efficient, best served if they developed a technical speaking bureau approach, whereby they would have the public speakers would be technical engineering, people with technical engineering expertise that would be shuttling out into the community instead of trained public communications consultants, professionals, and hence.
In this case, you do concede that in establishing the ranking for the two prospective bidders, that the procurement selection team did consider the qualifications of the subcontractors or subconsultants, including Compaq, in this particular case.
Yes. We concede that.
All right. So if the city is able to substitute a different contractor, doesn't that subvert the whole purpose of the having an independent selection team look at the qualifications of the team who's making the proposal and ranking them? And doesn't that, how do you respond to if we agree with your view that the exclusive remedy bars a subcontractor from raising any claim, that this somehow would create a big loophole in how the system's supposed to work?
I believe the key distinction is you're dealing with proposed and subcontractors, not the bidders. And that's all the code. The code only addresses the prime contractors that are selected. Now, we don't think it's an absurd or unjust ruling to limit the parties to the individuals or the parties who have independent standing to bring a protest. But like we were saying, there was nothing. This is a remedy. They're not completely left without a remedy. There's nothing in the code that would have stopped them from securing an obligation from Parsons, saying, hey, if we're going to be part of your team, we're going to have some assurances that we're going to rely on this, we're going to get at least this amount of share. And the moment Parsons has information that their proposed or their original idea of what their scope of work is going to be was going to be diminished, the onus should be on Parsons. They could have lodged a complaint or a protest. At that point, under the code, the procurement process stops. This matter is heard.
What would have been wrong with the city just telling Parsons, we don't like your approach to the public relations aspect of this, your proposal, can you come back with it? This is what we'd like. Can you come back with a different...
Whereas, as set forth, Your Honor, in the letter, that was developed. That the change in the policy was developed jointly between Parsons and the city over the course of the confidential negotiations.
I have to admit that the correspondence in there, this was forced upon Parsons, right?
I'm sorry?
This was forced upon Parsons. They didn't seek... They wanted to work with Compaq. They'd worked with Compaq in the past, had a relationship, and now all of a sudden they're being told, you got to substitute this entity that they've never worked with before, who happens to be...
Your Honor, we would respect...
involved with...
Your Honor, we would respectfully disagree that there is evidence for the court to infer that. The record that is the letter that is in the record describes a joint discussion and agreement between the Parsons and the city. And I believe certainly there is evidence in the record from Compaq's president, who has a decidedly opinionated, one-sided view of how this all transpired. But we would submit to you that Mr. Hamayasu's letter, as set forth in black and white, confirms that this was a part of a legitimate joint discussion process with Parsons and the city, under permitted by the code, in developing the scope of work for the project.
So your view of the statutory scheme is that it's really contractor bidder focused, and that the process itself is not focused on the qualifications necessarily of the subcontractors or subconsultants.
Yes, Your Honor, especially...
Given that in the entire scheme, if a subconsultant or a subcontractor has a dispute, they're out of luck. They can't raise.
If a subcontractor has dispute, they should their remedy is through the prime contractor. There is nothing in the code that prevents them from securing up their obligations or their commitments from the prime.
Well, wouldn't the exclusive remedies provision apply to disputes between contractor and subcontractor? In other words, you got a dispute, but it's involved or in connection with the bidding process, so you got to go through the statute, but the statute doesn't give the subcontractor any ability to raise any claim. I mean, are they really just out of luck in that?
We believe that the exclusive remedies provision doesn't give the subcontractor independent standing basis to raise a protest, but certainly the complaints against the city and the opportunity to have the contract modified and have their share, have the awarding of the contract modified to put back their share, they would have that opportunity provided they would have secured Parsons' cooperation in that regard. The remedy provision in 706 and 707 specifically allow for a modification of the contract.
So under the procurement code, if you have a construction contract or a supply contract, construction contract, you have to list your subcontractors, and you can't change it, right?
Right. Well, in terms of professional services?
No, I'm talking just overall the approach of the procurement code. For construction contractors, you have to list your subs. You can't substitute once the bid is accepted.
Okay, Your Honor. Correct?
Otherwise, you're going to have bid shopping. And then for RFPs or two-step RFPs, once the proposal is submitted, unless you either seek new proposals or in the process of doing the two-step, you say, refine your proposal and then submit it with a price. So there's some checks and balances there. But in the competitive negotiation for professional services, all you're doing is asking for qualifications. And then there's these secret negotiations between the government and the professional, and you're saying there's no way. It just is subject to corruption, if you will. And how do we guard against that,
Your Honor?
The purpose of the bidding laws is to avoid that.
But Your Honor, we believe that the city in the RF Q scenario that we have in a procurement for professional services don't know how to get around not giving the city flexibility to develop the agreed upon scope of work. And so there's been no evidence, Your Honor, there's no evidence of bad faith, a crime that has been committed. In this particular case, the record establishes that all discussions that went on were permitted, and that it went towards developing a change in the type of service that was going to be provided.
I'd agree with you if the contractor was able to decide who that subcontractor was based on the revised scope of services, but you're forcing a subcontractor on the contractor.
The type of service that the new subcontractor was going to be providing were different in nature. It's not simply a PR, one PR firm getting shifted out for another PR firm. This is a community planning engineering, a different type of firm, a different type firm providing different types of services.
Are there other firms like that in the community?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'm not so focused on whether in this particular case the substitution was proper or improper, because if it was proper, then presumably the city would prevail in its interference with economic advantage lawsuit, right? Okay, but I guess my question is, assuming it was improper, how does the statutory scheme, as you interpret it, deal with that situation? In other words, the city improperly substituting a subcontractor, and forcing the bidder to use that subcontractor. I mean, how does the statutory scheme, as it's currently in existence, how does the scheme address that situation?
It doesn't specifically address that situation, and hence we put the onus. You would have the onus on. Because the exclusivity provision is so broad, I mean, there, under that particular scenario, it would seem that there would be somewhat of an unjust result, but you have to look at the legislative history. You have to look at the intent of the legislature in passing the law. And in passing the law, the legislature clearly made a determination that they're going to made a policy determination that sub-consultants in a professional service context, such as these, like Compaq, are just not going to be afforded specific independent standing.
Your view is under statutory scheme, you can't please everyone. You got to make compromises. The legislature made this is the call. Look, we're going to make sure the contractors are handled properly. We're going to rely, but we don't want this thing to spawn litigation. So that's why we give the remedy to the contractors, subcontractors. Sorry, but you're out of luck because of the policy of limiting litigation and making this process smooth.
The legitimate public purpose of for the procurement code, expediting the process and providing a streamlined process that essentially limits or expedites the entire procurement process. And I agree with Mr. Tomlinson. Parties are standing on their briefings, but heretofore there has not been any facial constitutional challenge on the provision as well. And so we've provided our briefing as to why we believe 704 passes constitutional muster. We believe and we would ask that the court apply the plain meaning.
This contract is paid for mostly by federal funds, so are there any federal requirements that govern this contract in terms of contracting for subs?
I believe that there will be. I believe that there eventually will be federal requirements that are going to attach to the funding source. I am not. I apologize to the court. I'm not prepared to understand or get into the details as to the nature of what those federal restrictions could be. I also do not know if what the status of the federal funding is as well.
Now, if we permitted this tortious interference claims by subcontractors to go forward, what's the downside to the city? I mean, why would that be a bad result in terms of, in this particular case, because they're outside of the procurement code, they're saying that the project itself is not being stayed, there's no stopping, it's just a separate collateral money damages claim.
Right, but you're saddling the city with potential monetary liability for actions that they're taking under the procurement code. I mean, the examples that we had pointed out, there are all kinds of practical difficulties if a subcontractor during the course of the project is changed out or can't find bonding and the like, and the city makes a determination and that subcontractor disagrees with that assessment, all of a sudden the city is open to potential money damage claims. And the irony of the situation would be the prime contractor in that respect wouldn't have an ability to sue the city for money damages specifically outside of the realm of 704. So we believe the better reading, the only reading, permitted reading, is to understand that the legislature made a distinction. In 701, when they gave them that right, they identified the specific parties who could have standing to file a protest. In 704, as discussed in the Carl decision, the legislature had the opportunity to take a narrower view, didn't. And we have to assume that they intended to do to broaden the scope of persons that would be barred in the spirit for the purpose of furthering the legitimate public purpose of an expedited procurement
process.
So
you're saying the rational basis for that distinction between remedies being narrower than exclusivity provision being broader was to avoid the chilling effect of the city being able to negotiate with a contractor about subcontractors or other aspects of the contract that were not finalized.
Yes, Your Honor.
I have difficulty understanding your. You talked about the city being handcuffed, I guess, if they don't have. Let me back up. I don't understand why a government agency in contracting with someone wouldn't want that contractor to be totally liable and responsible for performing under a contract. Why you would force people on them, and therefore, if that subcontractor doesn't work out, who's responsible?
Non-performance. Your Honor, I think the difficulty that you have, that you're having, has to be thought about in the context of this particular and the timing of this particular procurement process. The changing out of Compaq came during the process of the city developing the scope of work. I mean, this isn't a competitive steel bidding process where the scope is decided and everything comes in and you're judging bid proposals, one against one, apples to apples. This is a procedure or a process that is developing. And 304 is very clear that while there are definitely rating requirements for prime contractors, the city still needs to be able to have the flexibility to figure out what the scope of the work is going to be. And so you have a legitimate concern, Your Honor, but I believe in the timing of this particular circumstance justifies the result that the trial court gave.
Mr. Thomason mentioned the campaign contribution law, and under that law, campaign contributions are prohibited by state or county contractors while they have a contract with the government. So, but there's no similar provision for subcontractors. So how do we prevent the pay-to-play by subcontractors in situations like this if the government's going to force subcontractors on consultants?
Your Honor, I believe that's a legitimate concern. That's clearly a legislative concern, and I think that should be addressed in the code. But I don't believe that concern can drive any overturning of the trial court's decision in this case based upon the code as it's written today.
Would you address yourself to the federal case law then in terms of allowing an exception where subcontractors can sue if the government has forced or interfered with the relationship between the contractor and the subcontractor?
I believe all of the federal case law on those points are based upon a different regulatory system. And again, the policy concerns that this court is having really flow or should be are more appropriately directed to the legislative branch of the government and to refine, perhaps pass narrower or stricter administrative rules or amend the code. But I don't believe it's proper for the law or for the judicial branch to be making those types of determinations based upon the wording of the code now. And certainly, Your Honor, you have a legitimate concern, but it's just not a part of the record of this case.
Counsel, you said earlier that there was nothing to prevent Compaq from basically obtaining a contractual relationship that secured their rights to the work in this project, so to speak. In your view, does the procurement code prevent any action? Say they had done that. They had reached some kind of agreement that Parsons would assert their rights within the procurement system, and Parsons failed to do so in their view. Do you see the exclusivity provision of the procurement code preventing them from taking Parsons to court on the contractual claim?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Their remedy is through Parsons. At that point, Parsons would be an aggrieved, even though they had won the bid, they would clearly be aggrieved. They're facing a contractual liability in that respect. And there would be the opportunity under the code to see whether or not the procuring officer or through the code process, the contract could be modified. But in terms of a contractual breach, their remedy would be through Parsons.
Through Parsons in court.
I'm sorry. We would be asked to Parsons for a breach of a specific obligation.
In court on a contract action.
In a court on a contract action under those facts, Your Honor.
They don't have a contract with Parsons.
And Your Honor, they don't have one. They didn't have either chose not to get one or was unable to effect that. And But to hold the city liable for their inability to do that is not the proper result here. We, in particular, when we read the Nihi Leva case, one of the factors that the court, it was a different set of facts, but it got into the question of whether or not the department, the procurement officer's interpretation of the term issuance was absurd or unjust because it had led, it would lead to the narrowing or the lessening of time under which a protester would have to file a request for a hearing. Well, under the facts of that case, part of the problem had been the protester had sent the timely request to the wrong department. And what the Supreme Court said was, well, we look at this situation, facts where this result could have been avoided. Because it could have been avoided, we make a determination that the city's interpretation of the term issuance doesn't create an unjust result because the facts were within the protester's control to avoid the problem. We would think, we submit that this situation is analogous. I see my time is up. Thank you.
I would add to the court one comment. In the description of the award of professional services contracts, I would encourage you to read the statute and not rely on the city's argument. The negotiation is to determine the rate of compensation. The government publishes a statement of work identifying a class of work to be performed. The contractor in this solicitation was required to identify specific subcontractors to perform specifically identified work. The city later says that we changed in our negotiation of the scope of the work who would be performing the work. The work really didn't change. They still had a public outreach obligation under the federal procurement or the federal funding statute for grant law. But in this case, what has really happened is there's an identification of who will perform the work instead of what the work will be. So when this city argues in this method, they're really misstating that procurement, competitive procurement process for professional services. I urge the court to recognize that if the city identifies a need to change significantly the scope of the work, they have the right to amend the solicitation, issue it to all competitors, afford them an opportunity to identify a speaker's bureau, and then resubmit their proposals with the identifying subcontractors. It is not the purview of the contracting officer to negotiate who will be performing the work behind closed doors.
Now, I'm not that clear on the scope of this tortious interference with prospective business advantage claim. It seems to me that as I look at the elements just on their face, it doesn't really require proof of any improper conduct upon the city. So I'm a little concerned that if about the chilling effect in the negotiation process. In other words, if every time a subcontractor is switched out or changed, that they can then sue the city, am I missing something in terms of the elements of the tortious interference claim, or is there something that requires some kind of improper or unfair or some kind of bad conduct by the city before you can go forward with that claim?
Your Honor, in the obligation of Communication Pacific is, if it is allowed to pursue this claim, the obligation would be to demonstrate that the city did engaged in this interference in a wrongful manner. The city has a license to do a number of things that could potentially interfere with a subcontractor's rights. Among the things that it can do is, after award of a contract, you can issue a change. After award of a contract, it can discover information. For instance, bonding is not available to a subcontractor. That makes them ineligible. They, in effect, in default. So the government can exercise its rightful powers as a contracting partner without liability. But in this case, what we're trying to point out is,
For the tort, you're saying there has to be some kind of bad faith or improper conduct or lack of good cause or some standard?
There is a standard. I would encourage, we also cited the Hawaii Medical Association versus HMSA, that the interferer's acts have to be without license and wrongful. And in this context, what Communications Pacific has alleged in its complaint, and what, if we have discovery, we hope to be able to demonstrate, is that these actions behind the closed doors, even as described in this letter, are improper under the procurement code. There is no license on the part of the city to identify a subcontractor without allowing all competitors to have an equal opportunity to nominate their subs as to this new, supposedly changed statement of work. My time again is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.